Hi everybody. Welcome to Sunday morning. Okay, so let's settle down. We'll set our motivation, say a few prayers together and then engage with the class. So please just get comfortable in your seat. So your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed. Your head is sitting naturally upon your neck, and you can have your eyes open or close them. And then let your body breathe itself. And letting the body breathe itself, relax into awareness. Then imagine that the ground beneath you is completely pure, made of lapis lazuli light. It's smooth and soft. And the space above you is filled with offerings and rainbow light. In the space in front of you, sitting on a lion throne, on cushions of lotus, sun and moon, is Lama Tsongkhapa. He is the essence of all our kind teachers, and he is surrounded by an assembly of direct and indirect teachers, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and deities. There are solitary conquerors, the heroes, and the Dharma protectors. And we are surrounded by all sentient beings. So take a few moments to appreciate that you're still alive today. There are many people we know who have already passed on. And we are still alive and we have the leisure and opportunity to attain any spiritual goal that we set our heart upon. We do need to act quickly. Things do not exist as they seem to. But while things are not quite right, we have met a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So I'd like you to imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. You have a divine identity and a clear appearance. You're holding a vajra and bell. And you want to make this offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. So with that in mind, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Imagine that from the heart of each refuge being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your lifespan is increased, along with your virtues and realizations. So feeling cleansed by wisdom and fortified with compassionate love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts and decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable and boundless states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So from the heart of each refuge being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your lifespan and good health are increased, along with your virtues and realizations. So you just sort of relax into your empowered state. And from this state, invite the field for accumulating merit, which appear. And before them you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So to prevent us clinging to the merit that we've accumulated, we want to stop all appearances of a samsaric world and its inhabitants. So imagine that all of our enjoyments, all of our merit, everything we possess, this body, speech and mind, are all utterly transformed to reappear as the world of a Buddha, a completely enlightened environment. And we offer this to Lama Tsongkhapa and his entourage. So we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayatayami. So the offering has been released and accepted by Lama Tsongkhapa, and he smiles at us with delight. We meet his gaze, and in his eyes we find immense humility, kindness, and great wisdom. We recollect the three principal aspects of the path. And we see that from the heart of the Lama, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments and all beings. And these all dissolve into light and are gradually gathered up into the field of merit. And this dissolves into the central figure, Lama Tsongkhapa. It now moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head. Diminishes in size and enters the crown of your head, descending down to your heart. His mind and your mind become of one nature. And within that nature, you hear the sound of the mantra, Om Guru Vajradhara Sumati Keti Siddhi Hum. Om Guru Vajradhara Sumati Keti Siddhi Hum. Om Guru Vajradhara Srimati Keti Siddhi Hum. I think the two purposes have been achieved. You've accomplished your own enlightenment and you've helped everybody else do the same. They acknowledge that this is only on the level of imagination. And to make this a reality, we need to realize each stage of Lama Tsongkhapa's path. Fully awaken ourselves by understanding deeply that path and accumulating the merit and purifying the mind. So decide to do this and to repay the kindness of all sentient beings and our teachers, we will become fully awakened for the benefit of all beings. And then breathe it in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open if they're closed. Okay, so we've got the second stage of class R20, and there are 13 questions in this section. So the first question asks us, how does Baba Viveka hold that any reason posited must be realized? So what he's basically saying here is that a reason must be a commonly agreed upon solid fact. This is basically what he's saying. So Sue, would you like to see what you've got with this first question?
Okay, Eddie. Baba Viveka says we have to realize the correct reason, the three modes, where the subject, the predicate, and the example all are inherently existent conventionally.
Yep.
And that all the valid cognition can be traced back to a valid direct perception.
Okay. Does anybody get some? I just saw Linda's eyebrows go up and down. What do you think, Linda? What did you come up with?
I didn't get all of that out of it. I just thought it said that it had to be realized by an unmistakable consciousness that holds, which means that it's holding inherent existence. It's true.
That's great. That's fine. Yep. But just like you said, Sue, but both those answers are correct. What's he saying? A reason and argument must be a real objective fact, meaning another intrinsically existent, proven by valid perception, that is not mistaken about the reason's inherent nature. So just like what Linda said, just as Sue has said, basically Baba Viveka is saying that these phenomena inherently exist, and the reasoning has to support that.
But I think, Eddie, that, you know, what Sue added in there is important for the later questions, that if it's not the reason itself, then it has to be the things that can be traced back. And so that starts to get that whole point of dependent arising and causes conditions, which they use later to also contradict their consequentialist views. So I think that's an important point here too that Sue mentioned.
About each part of the reasoning?
That it goes back. So if it's not the direct reason in the syllogism, then it has to be traced back to that something has to be realised as essentially existing in the reason.
Sure, okay. So do the middle way consequence agree with us? And why? So Dhamma, do the middle way consequences agree with what Baba Viveka has said and the autonomists?
I've got no.
Yeah,
basically because things do not exist inherently.
Yeah, but that's it. That's right. The answer is no, of course. Because any perception that apprehends an inherent nature is fundamentally mistaken. Our third question is, what is the main reason Lama Tsongkhapa asserts on page 267 as to why the others have the faults he has argued against in the previous chapter? Maybe Linda, you start off with this one, if you would mind.
I'll see how I go.
Yeah.
So others have these faults because they accept that phenomena exist by way of their own character.
Yes.
Which is these autonomous arguments.
Yep, yep.
But we, the motorway consequence school, I don't know whether we're in it or not, do not accept inherent existence. So the autonomous arguments say that both parties must accept inherent existence. So that's why we don't have that fault.
Yeah, yeah. Caroline, could you add anything to this, or you have the same similar answer?
No, I had the same as that. It's sort of, yeah.
Okay. And Chris, how do you feel about this?
Oh, yeah, very similar, just slightly different language, just basically saying that the reason he gives others have these false lies and the acceptance of autonomous arguments, which refers to syllogisms, and since consequentialists do not accept autonomous arguments, we do not have those faults.
Fantastic. Okay, so this brings us to our first meditation. So what I've done is sort of gone through this material and tried to break it off in little parts and go, oh, that part just deals with this. Next part deals with slightly different material, and we'll put a meditation between each of the little gaps. So this is the first part. So let's do our first meditation. So again, just get comfortable in your seat and bring awareness to your breath as it's felt in the body. You'll probably be able to feel the subtle rise and fall of your body with each inhalation and exhalation. So we want this meditation to be an altruistic opportunity to build a bridge of understanding within ourselves and then with others. So we have an idea that the arguments we build depend entirely on the ground they stand upon. The core reason our discussions falter is that we assume our facts are an objective reality shared by everyone. And the consequence of this is that we talk past each other. We're unable to find a meeting point. It's like two people trying to build a bridge from a foundation that only one believes is solid rock. So why is it that sometimes our discussions feel so stuck, as if we are speaking in different languages? This is because our arguments are often based on fundamentally different worldviews. This makes our reasons are incompatible. So how might we build a stronger foundation for connection when our viewpoints seem worlds apart? Perhaps we could begin not by proving our facts, but by finding a single shared intention that we both agree on. So I wonder what might change if we approached our next disagreement not to win, but to understand the ground that the other person is standing on. The shift would foster humility and open up a space for dialogue instead of conflict. So middle way autonomous and middle way consequences are like two people with completely different perspectives. So two people try to build a bridge from a foundation. Only one believes the solid rock. So perhaps in our next conversations, or your next conversations, we can seek to find one shared stone of belief, something we can both stand on. In this way, we could transform disagreements into powerful opportunities for connection. So breathing in and then exhaling. So I've sort of created a little bit of a different meditation there, more on the sort of consequences of what happens when you have this fundamental disagreement of how reality exists. Right, so you can see here the middle way consequentialist and the middle way autonomous cannot meet through the syllogism. Right, when one is seeing everything as inherently existent, one is not that at all. So the thing is, so where can we, what can we agree upon? Where can we meet? So our next question is, it says to give an example of an inference based on what others accept. So Delma, would you like to do this one? Have a go at this one? This is big, this is the big one about the eye, I think. So I've got a big eye on the screen.
I'm not going to have a go at this because I thought about it and I was actually going to come back to the do the question, but I didn't. So okay. I passed.
That's fine. Yeah, good, good. Linda.
I'm not sure about this. I've got it sitting over the page.
That's fine.
I don't know. Take sound, it does not arise due to causes, conditions, because it's permanent. Now that was a consequence, I think, doesn't it? No, that's the consequence one. Yeah. I don't know what I did with that. Sorry, Eddie.
It's okay. It's fine. But this was not. This is. Yeah. Chris.
Eddie, what I could find is, and I'm not sure it's the answer, is that it's an inference is based on what others accept in an autonomous syllogism. And therefore, the arguments found in texts such as clear words are arguments based on what the other party accepts. Their sole purpose then is to refute the other party's thesis.
Yes, right, yeah. And so, this is correct, yeah. Carolyn?
I was a bit confused by this because I did it was saying things about, you know, take the eye, it does not see other things because it does not see itself,
yeah.
But it sees other things as lacking essential existence. So it's sort of like I sort of couldn't quite understand what it was saying, really. But in the end, on what others accept is that other things, you know, exist by way of their own character. So you develop the syllogism based on that.
Okay. Sue?
Carolyn had the inference. So the example of it was consider the eye, that's the subject. It does not see other things like blue. And the reason is because it does not see itself. And the example is just like a pot.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is this thing here, right? The eye doesn't see other things because it does not see itself. This was the example of the inference. The eye does not see other things. Why? Because it does not see itself. The argument is based on what the opponent already accepts, that an eye cannot truly see itself.
So who accepts that, Eddie? Is that autonomous and consequent?
No, this is a consequence of what the autonomists believe. So they believe that an eye does not see itself. Right? So they go, okay, great, we'll take that then. And then it says that it does not cannot see other things. It can't truly see itself, that it can't truly see other things. So this argument is based on what the opponent already accepts, that an eye cannot truly see itself. It then uses that shared starting point to show a contradiction in their other belief, that the eye inherently or independently sees other things. Right? And so the idea of doing this is to get them to question their own belief, as it does, doesn't it? I mean, as soon as you see this, you go, no, no, hang on a minute. Of course my eye sees other things. Right? So there's a contradiction here, right? It's obvious. And this is what the middleway consequence are doing, by taking something that they already understand and then go, well, if you guys agree that the eye does not see itself, we can take that, we'll go with you, we agree. The eye does not see itself. Therefore, it would follow that the eye cannot see other inherently existent things. So they're trying to, again, they're using the opponent's own logic to show a contradiction. I mean, when you see something like this, it's pretty wacky, isn't it? Don't you think? It really gets your attention and go like, you go like, what? What? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah, so they take the part that the other side does agree on, because the eye does not see itself. So this is their starting point.
Linda, do you remember the three modes? So do you understand this one?
Yeah, I remember the three modes.
So they're using the eye, and you're establishing the position property first. The eye does not see itself. They believe that. Mm-hmm. They establish the position property, and they would accept the position property is established. But then when they go to look at the forward and reverse pervasion, they can't make sense of it. If it does not see itself, then it does not see other things. And that's where it untangles them or starts giving them doubt when you look at the reverse and the forward pervasions. But you start off with something they accept, with the position property. The eye does not see itself.
Thanks.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
It's very good. Very nice and clear the way you said that.
It helps. Linda and I have done a bit of this for years, so yeah.
Yeah, and just to say it carefully and slowly, like, it's really good for us too. You know, we can sort of get an idea then of how the syllogism is set out. And you're talking about, you know, the subject matter, the forward pervasion and so forth, but you go backwards, you go, hello, this ain't making, this ain't working.
Could you just explain that forward pervasion and backward pervasion, what they mean?
That's when you're looking at, so the subject is the eye.
Take the eye, yeah.
The predicate is not see other things, and the reason is it does not see itself. So the position property, it's a lot of information, Carolyn, looks at the eye does not see itself, the relationship between the subject and the reason. Now the forward pervasion and the reverse pervasion looks at the relationships between the reasons and the predicates and to see if they make sense in the forward way and in the reverse way. And if it was a correct inference or a correct syllogism, that would all make sense. But because it doesn't make sense to them, it starts to give way to doubt to them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so the predicate is the saying that the subject, the I, possesses the property of not seeing itself. And based on that, the perversion forward and backward is that, well, how does it see blue and how does that all work then? Is that sort of in a nutshell?
No, the predicate is not seeing other things. The eye does not see other things. So we're looking at the relationship between not seeing itself. If it does not see itself, is it absolutely essential that it does not see other things? That's the forward pervasion. And you can think of reasons where that isn't true. So it doesn't hold up.
We'll be coming back to that in the last questions when there's... when there's four things. Okay.
Okay, so next question asks, why is it important to link your argument to the position that others hold? Is Bruce still there? Are you there, Bruce? There's Bruce. I can't hear you, mate. Your phone's off. Well, you stop moving around. Your phone is disconnected from the sound, Bruce. Yeah, we can't hear you. Okay,
How's
there
that?
you go. Try that.
Sorry about that.
That's
Yeah,
okay.
look,
Oh, sorry.
I stuffed up the readings. I was on the wrong readings, but I think for this questions, why is it important to link your argument to the position that other cells, so that it will make sense to your to the opponent when you contradict it. So there's a common ground on which you can argue on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we've got to have some. We have to start within their framework, basically. Right, so that's, we saw that with the other one here, wasn't it? We go like, they agree, the frame, they agree that the eye does not see itself. So we can take that there, we start there. Right, then you can point out the contradiction, sorry. We have to start, like says here, within their framework. We find something that they've said that we can agree with, and then we, what can you say, show them the consequences of that belief. Yes, because we don't share their belief in a solid ground of facts, we can't argue from one. In other words, we say, because we don't agree that phenomena inherently exist, we can't start from there. Right? But we can find something that they've said and then take that and then show the consequence of it.
It's sort of to break down their fixed view of it so that they start doubting it and relinquish what they believe. So it's not to
that's
win
right,
the
yeah.
argument so much as help them
Oh,
to understand their mistake.
yeah. So this is an interesting thing here. So we're not, I said before in the meditation, we have to start from something that we can agree upon. But well, we know the agreement is not an inherent existence. Right? So the agreement here is we understand that each of us is suffering. We know that the suffering comes about from grasping at inherent existence. So we're not trying to beat them or win arguments here. We're trying to help them release the most deepest form of suffering there is, which is grasping at inherent existence. So question six asks, how is a consequence based on what others hold used to create doubt in what these others accept and to lead them to relinquish their position? So I'll, what did I get for an answer like this? Yeah. So this is all sort of around the same idea here, right? We use the person's own beliefs to show an internal contradiction within their own belief. This is what the syllogism does, isn't it? So it says, so before we took this view that they actually hold, that the eye sees inherently. Right? Because all phenomena exist inherently, so whatever apprehends must inherently exist. Right? But this would reveal and reveals a logical result they don't accept. Then it must also see itself. You know, and that's the thing, is like, oh shit, okay, I get it. Yeah, it basically shows contradictions with their own logic. So the idea here is that with this type of conversation, these types of conversations, we're trying to bring about a sense of doubt within the other person. They doubt what we want them to doubt what they originally assert, and the doubt here is not, it's not a weakness, right? It's we have doubts that tend towards the wrong way, doubts that tend towards the correct way, and what they call equal doubt. So we want the mind to go tending towards the correct understanding. This is a powerful, non-confrontational way to help someone reevaluate a rigid belief. Instead of attacking their view, you show its unintended consequences. This encourages self-reflection rather than defensiveness, making it possible for them to change their own mind without feeling defeated, leading to a more productive and respectful conversation. And I wish I could, I could speak like this. Well, one day, I mean, sometimes when Gessler does this, isn't it? You sort of go like, what? What? I do it, and it's just like, what are you talking about? And this is what he's done, is used consequences. So even though I think it's a great idea, perhaps it might not be actually in the real world. You just get people shaking their head at you.
Eddie, this is just so powerful, you know, even just commonly in everyday life, you know, this was taught in schools when we were younger, you know, rather than being competitive and winning at all costs, like was ingrained into us, and you take that into like the workplace or whatever. You know, when I look at your beautiful language, though, of rather just, you know, reevaluating fixed positions, but self-reflection rather than defensiveness. Because a lot of us were taught, even though, you know, in our careers, that, you know, get to a position and defend it, you know, come hell of high water, especially in front of the executive, for example. And it was ingrained in us, Freddie, you know, from, you know, particularly on technical arguments. So wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it had this, it left me with an exercise that we could do. It says, if you have, if you're into a discussion of some sort and you see, there's a point that they've raised which you disagree with. He says here, so ask your friend, if that's true, what would be the logical consequence? Well, that's what it's sort of doing, isn't it? All right. I mean, that's what the middleway consequences are doing, aren't they? Without saying that, they're just, you know, they're doing it within the syllogism format, right? But that's basically what they're saying. If what you're saying is true, then what would be the logical consequence? Except, instead of asking them that, they pull it out themselves and say, here's the logical consequence of your thinking. Okay, so now question 7. It says, do consequences accept and use syllogisms in which the three modes are established by valid awareness? So, Sue, would you like to go first?
I said yes, yeah. They do, but however, they do it in a specific way that distinguishes them from the autonomous.
Fantastic. That's great. So that answers this question and the next one, basically, right? Is everybody else on the page saying yes, they do use syllogisms and they do accept valid awareness? Because they do, and that's great. So everyone's on the right page there.
No, I just added that the purpose of why they do is for the soul, one of getting others to see the how you can refute their thesis, you know, so gain the logic of their contradiction and the logic of their syllogisms.
Okay. And last one, the answer, of course, is no. And reason being because they don't accept inherent existence. Yeah. The ideas of valid awareness are fundamentally different. So the autonomist is believing in believes a common, unmistaken awareness is possible, and this is because they accept that things have a conventional, inherent nature that can be known. The consequentialists, however, see all ordinary awareness as subtly mistaken, because while things appear to exist autonomously, independently, inherently, they don't. So there's no shared, objectively correct awareness to use as a common ground for argument. Anything you guys would like to mention, talk about in this last little section here before we do the meditation?
Um,
Eddie, did we, on the bottom of page 52 of the notes, the very bottom, it sort of say, I didn't understand, so what others accept from our perspective and what the self accepts from that person's perspective are mutually inclusive, the same thing. What was all that bit about there?
I have no idea what that means.
Oh, good.
Jeez, what sort of sentence is that?
Yeah, oh good. I just, you know, it just sent me like, thank you.
No, I'm sorry, Carol, I can't help there.
I think I'll just go with how you're expressing it, Eddie, as Chris says, it's very good.
Okay, well, let's do this next meditation and we'll take it from there. So again, let's get comfortable in the seat. Okay, let the body settle. And just gently bring your attention to the rhythm of your breath. And with each exhalation, relax into awareness. I think that we're engaged in an altruistic practice, and what we're offering is our clarity. We've decided to transform every conflict that we meet into connection. And we begin to do this by sort of thinking about how often our conversations can become blocked. It feels like we're engaged in a battle of wills. And the key insight here is to stop pushing our own views and instead compassionately enter the world of the other person. By doing so, we can use our own reasoning to gently reveal a more spacious perspective. It's like using your opponent's own momentum in judo. So in judo, you know, we're not pushing them, we are guiding their own force, we're guiding their own force to bring them to a new understanding. So how might we connect with someone whose reality seems completely opposed to our own? We begin by genuinely listening. We try to find a single belief that they hold, and then we explore its consequences alongside them. But what inner obstacle prevents us from adopting this gentle approach? Well, often it's our own attachment to being right. It blocks our ability to listen with an open heart. So what's the final aim of the consequent method if it's not to win the argument? So the goal is to create a moment of shared insight. Trying to help, the consequent argument helps both people see beyond their own fixed positions. trying to use the force that's often that often plays its part in arguments to bring about new understandings gently. So in our next disagreement, let's try to find one point of the other's logic to build upon with curiosity. Let's try to use this skillful path to lead us from argument to shared discovery. Now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. Okay, so look, we're really motoring through these questions. We don't have all that many to go. 10, 11, 12, 13. Okay, let's have a look at our first question. This is question 9. It's a nice one, isn't it? What's a consequence? So Sue, I think I'll go through everybody, just ask you, see what you come with. I think this could be nice for all of us. Sue, what's the question is, what's a consequence? What have you come up with? Oh, am I being heard? Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. So Sue, you're looking a bit puzzled. Are you there?
I think she might be frozen.
Ah, it looks like, yeah, maybe that's what it is. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dama. Yeah. Okay, so Chris, maybe you go first. Chris, would you tell us your answer for what is the consequence?
I had something very short. I said a consequence is an effect from a cause under certain conditions.
Oh, this is a consequence. Okay. A consequence is an effect. Say that again, Chris.
A consequence is an effect from a cause under certain conditions.
Okay. Okay. That is a consequence. Delma, what do you think?
Well, I agree with what Chris says, but I found that in the context of the Madhyamaka logic, it refers to a specific form of reasoning and debate.
Okay, that's good. That's right. That's true too. That's right. Is there anything more you'd like to add to that, or should I give it to Caroline and see what she has to say?
Let's hand over to Caroline. Okay. Tag Caroline.
We've got it. 1, 2. Caroline, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I was using it in the context of, the consequences is also related to the inferential knowledge that comes from the sort of syllogisms that the middle way consequence people use to demonstrate the consequence comes from reasoning. So, yes.
Okay.
So I just added that bit.
Sure. And Linda, what would you like to say?
I've got that it's a logical statement or a form of reasoning that shows the illogical consequence of an opponent's position and leads them to doubt.
Excellent. And Bruce, anything you'd like to say about the consequence if you're there?
Yeah, just in general terms, as a result.
Yeah. So in the general terms, it's just like Bruce has said, it's a result, and like Chris has said, it's an effect that follows from certain causes and conditions, but here within the context of the differences between middle way and autonomy or the idea of reasoning and so forth, it's a logical tool, right? And just like Linda's pointed out, you're trying to reveal the absurd but necessary outcome of someone's own belief. So just what you said, that's fine, it's quite correct. So consequences, that they don't prove a separate point. It functions by taking a person's own premise and showing that it leads to a conclusion that they find unacceptable. And this generates doubt, not by attacking the abused, but by using their own logic to help them see its internal contradictions and then to gently relinquish it. Yes, it's a thinking tool. So again, it says, as an exercise, next time you disagree with somebody, ask them, what would be the logical result if that were completely true? So why do middleway consequences use consequences? What's the purpose? Linda, you have a go at this first, if you don't mind.
Yes. So they use them to try and help people to overcome their wrong assertions or their wrong ideas about things.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's great. That's nice and simple. Anybody else could add? You don't need really any more added to this. This is the point of a consequence.
And that they don't need shared valid cognitions or syllogisms to do it.
Yeah, that's also true, isn't it? That's dead right. That's right, Sue. Thank you for adding that. Yeah, that's right. That's a good point to bring up.
What does that mean exactly, though? Just tease it out a bit more?
That they don't need to state a syllogism like the autonomous do, and they don't have to have valid cognition, a shared valid cognition like the autonomous believe or imply that we have to have. A consequence will shortcut all that, bypass it.
Why do the autonomous not use consequences? That's an interesting question, isn't it? let's go, Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, my understanding is that because they hold the position that conventional objects exist inherently, and then they actually also hold that they arise due to cause and effect, right? They haven't taken that as a consequence, so they don't hold that position.
Okay. Okay, that's one. Okay. Linda, what would you like to add or say about this?
That they don't use them because they say that you can't develop an inference purely through using a consequence. You've got to use a correct reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Caroline?
I don't know any more than what others have said. I couldn't quite get my head around this one. By the time I got here, my head was done in.
These things take like 2 or 3 days to have a go at, don't they? I'll leave them and come back again. That's right. Sue?
I think because the autonomous believe that their syllogisms are sufficient and superior and that they rely on seeing the truth in their own words, not our words. So they see that as superior than what the consequences do.
Okay. Delma, anything you'd like to add to this?
Well, I cheated and just put this one into AI to help me understand it, but it came back with their view is that for an argument to be effective and meaningful, both the autonomous and their opponents' consequence must accept that the basis and basically the subject, predicate and reason all have to be established by valid cognition.
Okay, the valid cognition has to...
is established. So both middleway autonomy and middleway consequence have to accept the three criteria, all as established by valid cognition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so So basically, the autonomous think that the consequences don't completely fulfill the requirements of these debates. So they know, they understand that the middleway are refuting, but they don't build anything positive in their place. And so this is not acceptable by the autonomous. So autonomous don't use consequences because they see them as incomplete tools. For them, a proper argument must positively prove a point on a shared foundation of valid reasoning that both parties accept. A consequence, in their view, only shows the other person's logic is flawed, but it doesn't formally establish a correct shared understanding. They prefer a structured affirmative proof that builds the case rather than one that just points out a contradiction. So for them, you know, true understanding, the autonomous, true understanding requires establishing a shared truth. But this truth, of course, for them is the truth of phenomena existing inherently, not that they're empty of that inherent nature. That's a big difference, right?
So, it's hard to get your head around that they can't accept or they won't listen to consequences, because given that, you know, the example that was earlier around, you know, sound, they say sound's impermanent, and then consequentialists will then say, well, if it sounds impermanent, but it relies on causes and conditions with palate and mouth and tongue and that, that, you know, how do you ever then, yeah, just, it's a bit gobsmacking, really, to work that through.
Yeah, so this idea comes right back to Bhava Viveka's arguments against Buddha Palita. Now, so Buddha Palita used just consequences and did not leave a positive example. And so these guys go, the whole thing is not complete then, eh? The syllogism is not complete. We don't have valid understanding based on the syllogism, for instance. So this is where the, you know, this is where the big argy bargy began. Then, of course, Chandrakirti comes along and says, Bhava Viveka has actually is grasping at inherent existence. And Buddha Palita was correct. Yeah, so these guys want something, well, they're sort of thinking if we just use consequences, we're not actually saying like so what's there? If there's nothing. Yeah, so in this way they sort of think we're he's gone sort of too far. You know, he got into nihilism here. So these guys have to present, you know, something to essentially exist. Okay, so what's the basic point? What's the basic point about the faults or of the faults that are found in others? Linda, would you like to have a go at this?
The reason why they use faults is to show them that they've got the wrong idea, to try and refute their idea or move them past their incorrect idea. So they use faults.
I didn't really answer this one, Eddie. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Caroline?
Well, it was sort of just the basic one, that to refute their position through and what they were putting forward.
Okay, Sue?
I think I understood it a little bit differently. What's the basic point of the faults that were found in others? And it comes back to the fault is that there are no inherently existent proofs, and also that it's a fault because it implies an impossible inherent reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Chris?
Yeah, just the basic point is that refutes objects and reason lack inherent existence, even conventionally.
Yeah. So this is, you know, the basic fault is that the systems of all the others, everyone that's not in middleweight consequences, is built on a non-existent foundation, the foundation being inherent existence. That's the fault of others. That's the fault. Others have the belief in inherent existence and think that we validly comprehend phenomena, That's about, you know, valid. No. The basic point is that their entire system of reasoning is built on a faulty foundation, the belief that things have some kind of inherent findable nature. They search for a shared, solid truth that both parties in a debate can agree on. And for consequences, this common ground is an illusion. Since the other's primary tool, the autonomous proof, requires this non-existent foundation to work, their whole approach is seen as flawed from the very start. This assumption of inherent existence, that's the foundation that they're building everything upon. And these guys are going, well, that's the fault, it's right there. There we come to this question 13, this might be the one you were referring to earlier, to Carolyn, where it says that, it's right up there, but I'll just say, if we, consequentialists, also accept the subject, the example, the reason, and the predicated quality, what's the difference in the way we assert how these are established? And basically, the answer was already up there, it has gone back a little. This is the major difference, isn't it? Everybody else is saying, no, valid awareness, conventionally reliable in the sense that phenomena do inherently exist. These guys are going, no, they're mistaken. So the difference, of course, is profound. Autonomists assert that a valid awareness establishes the parts of the syllogism as objectively real, creating a shared, solid foundation. Consequentialists, however, see this very awareness as conventionally reliable, but ultimately mistaken, because things only appear to have an independent nature. They accept the parts of the argument simply because that's how an ordinary, unimpaired mind works, not because it's inherently true. So it said for the key takeaway, we can see the same world, but our understanding of what that seeing means is completely different. I mean, isn't that so true? If you just think back about, I'm just thinking about the people you associate with, you're all looking at what you see as to be the same world, but what we understand of it is very, very different, isn't it? As an exercise, next time you're with somebody and you agree on a fact, ask, what does this fact mean to you? Okay, they're not objectively existent. That's what you'll probably discover pretty quickly. What does this fact mean to you?
So, Eddie, in page 53 of the notes, when it had, you know, the four columns in, I didn't understand at all, like, for instance, a vase. Like, where does that come from? Or is that too much of a conversation to have because it's all to do with this syllogism?
Well, if you have the syllogism there and you read it out, the subject, the vase is just the subject, I think. They'd probably just say, take a vase, and there we have your subject. Now it's going to be a predicate and then a reason, and then I'll probably give you an example.
No, it says, take an eye.
Okay.
It does not essentially see blue because it does not see itself like a vase.
Yep, okay. So then you have to say, take the vase and substitute some things. Well, the example of a vase does not see itself. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. That's what
Well, I wonder if there's material about this in the Geshe Sofa book. There may be. I know that there's parts of that that are very good, where he breaks down these sort of syllogisms and goes into each one into a bit more depth. I'll have a look, Caroline. I'll have a look in the Geshe Sofa book and see if there's something about this in that section. Because often, you know, we're not used to this type of reasoning and the way they, you know, like they do this, like a vase, you've got to go, what's a vase got to do with with this thing here?
And it's just, I'm not sure whose syllogism that they're talking about, whether that's consequences or autonomous or...
That's a consequence of putting forward a view that autonomous have already accepted about the eye not seeing itself, right? So that you can say, okay, they would have to agree with that. Now we, like for instance, and then they give the example of the vase. Okay, let's finish up and do our last meditation. So again, just adjust your posture. Have your shoulders relax and your back be straight. And let your body breathe itself. So we get to altruistically explore how to transform disagreements into an opportunity for a connection. So just consider, for instance, that insight arises not from force, but from a gentle invitation to see differently. The core reason our arguments fail is assuming a shared, solid reality that doesn't exist. The core reason our arguments fail is by assuming a shared, solid reality, which in fact does not exist. We then debate surface issues, unaware that our foundations are entirely different. They're a bit like architects arguing about a building's design, unaware that we've built it on a foundation of sand. Our entire structure is flawed. So what makes us cling so tightly to our own views? What makes us cling so tightly to our own ideas, our own views? So we mistake our perception to be objectively true. We believe our foundation is rock when it's only sand. So how can we help someone reconsider their position without causing conflict? How can we help someone reconsider their position without causing conflict? By using their own logic to reveal an unintended consequence. This creates space for self-reflection. So why is creating doubt more compassionate than winning an argument? Why is doubt more compassionate than winning the argument? So winning often creates resistance from the other, while doubt invites a shared journey toward deeper understanding. So perhaps in your next disagreement, you could gently ask the other, if that is true, where does it lead us? So, may the teaching we've engaged in today and our contemplations, our reflections, may all of this help us build bridges from argument to understanding. And now exhale through your mouth. Let your eyes flutter open if they're closed. And bring your awareness back up to the screen. So, we're very early, but we've gone through our questions. next day, of course, is day 21. And here's the material. So I think in day 21. I've got 13 questions from day 21. Anyway, I'll mail them out to you soon.
Okay.
And if you could please pass them on to everybody. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's dedicate our time this morning towards achieving enlightenment for all beings as a way of just repaying the kindness of our teachers and all sentient beings. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. For His Holiness's long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. Now for the quick discovery of Rinpoche's, the reincarnation of Rinpoche and his quick return to be amongst us. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, we wore the armour of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.